And coming up in a couple of weeks on Friday, October 28th, the UNC Parr Center for Ethics is hosting a symposium on the ethics of climate change. What are our responsibilities as individuals, as a community, as a nation, as a people when it comes to dealing with climate change? What can be done? What should be done? What are the best approaches? And what actually are our ethical obligations when it comes to addressing this very serious issue? It's an all-day symposium. Everyone's invited. It's the Graham Student Union that's going to be holding it from 9:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. on Friday, October 28th. There's three different sessions. And joining us now is Victor Flatt. He's an environmental law professor at UNC. He's also the director of the Climate Energy and the Center for Climate, Energy, Environment, and Economics at UNC Chapel Hill. He's going to be one of the speakers at the symposium coming up in a couple of weeks. Dr. Flatt, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on, Eric. Aaron.
Yeah. So research focuses, and we were talking about this before, you don't come out of it from a climatology background, you come out of it from a law background, but your research focuses on the public policy measures that we need to take in order to address climate change. So when it comes to that, what do we know right now about different proposals that have been offered or suggested, and which are and which are not the most effective?
That's how I got started, actually, from environmental law generally, about thinking about climate change, was thinking about which policies could work and why they could work and how, if we're going to put them into a law, that law needs to be written so that they do work effectively. I think there are sort of two big things that are out there that are pretty important. One is putting a price on carbon emissions. Everybody likes that. It's kind of the sexy economic blah, blah, blah thing. But it's important. And the reason it's important is it drives people to make decisions that are in the best interests of both themselves and the community when it comes to limiting greenhouse gases.
Is that cap and trade, or is that
it could be a tax, or okay, it could be cap and trade. And you probably don't want me to get into it. I have my own opinions about which of those are better and why. But either one puts a price on carbon.
Okay. Is there one that's more effective than another?
There's argument about that.
Okay.
I guess the thing I would say, though, now is that almost every other country that is working to address climate change and has put a price on carbon is using a cap and trade system. And so in that sense, there's kind of already a bit of path dependency. To the extent this is a worldwide problem, to the extent the United States has to work with other countries, it might actually at this point in time just be easier to do a cap and trade than a tax.
Okay, so path dependency, meaning if we had to start it all over again,
right,
we might go down one road, but right, we've already made decisions that take us down.
Yeah.
Right. All right, so that's where you're coming from as a law professor, and focusing on the legality and the law behind cap and trade policies or putting a price on carbon. What is the science behind the law, as it were? Like, is there such a difference in the way that the law can be written that you can approach the same policy one way with two different laws and make one effective and one completely ineffective?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, cap and trade is based on the idea that we want to control externalities, like bad things that affect people. We want people to take responsibility for those actions. And most of environmental law is based on that idea. You don't put bad things in the air. You have to control it. You have to pay to control it. And that's so that you make better decisions and you don't harm other people. And with cap and trade, the idea is relatively simple, but when you start to implement it, it can get complicated pretty quickly. And if you go back to 2008 and 2009, when there were multiple proposals in Congress to enact, in fact, a very large comprehensive cap and trade bill for greenhouse gases, I think things got a little too complicated too quickly, and they sort of missed the bigger idea of basically creating a cap, letting that cap reduce over time, setting that up, figuring out how to allocate the emission rights, and then making sure it's enforced. That's really the critical issue, is making sure it can be enforced.
If it had been simplified, do you think it would have passed?
Maybe.
Okay.
I think there were two objections against it. One, the Republicans said, and probably fairly in a way, that it was a tax.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they said that is because the emissions, the right to emit was going to be sold, and that money was going to be used for certain other things. And there was one bill at the time, a very simple bill offered by Maria Cantwell and Susan Collins, senators from Washington and Maine, called Cap and Dividend. And that was that you sell the rights to emit, but then you just go turn right around and give that money back to everybody in the form of a check. And that is the idea. That wouldn't be a tax then. People would get the money back.
Okay. Speaking with Dr. Victor Flanagan, director for the Center for Climate, Energy, Environment, and Economics at UNC, environmental law professor at the law school, and he's going to be speaking at the Parr Center for Ethics Symposium on Climate Change Ethics Friday, October 28th at the Graham Student Union. And the session that you're going to be in is one titled Responsibility for Climate Change and Duties to Other Nations. So what actually is our responsibility, just starting from a national level, since, you know, we know the statistic. Americans are, 12% of the world's population, and we use 164% of the world's energy, or so is it 25% of the world's energy?
Well, 4% of the population.
4% of the population, 25% of the energy.
Yeah.
That's right. So we use more than our share, as
right.
it were. So what is our responsibility?
Well, you can look at the responsibility in two different ways. One of the ways to look at it is the fact that greenhouse gases that are already in the atmosphere are causing harm right now to the world and will continue to do that in the future. Looking at it from that perspective, if you look at all the greenhouse gases in the air, the United States is responsible for the majority of them in the air. Now, China is coming up quickly, and on an annual basis, it's past the United States, but it's still nowhere near the total impact on greenhouse gas emissions that the United States has had throughout its history. So in that sense, we're primarily responsible for a lot of the impact that greenhouse gases are having, and we've prospered because of that.
Mm.
So that's one responsibility. And I think the other responsibility is in the same as any kind of pollution in an ongoing sense. We don't have the right to harm other people for our benefit. That's just a basic premise of common law in the English American system. That's why you can't run somebody down in your car because you're in a hurry to get to a meeting. We just don't have the right to do that.
Scientifically, is there any dispute that we are harming people?
Not in my view.
Okay.
I know that this issue's been politicized, and it's strange. The United States is really the only country in the world where it has been politicized. But I was just rereading a case today from the Supreme Court in 2006 where they ordered the EPA to make a determination of whether, you know, greenhouse gases cause harm to the public. And at that time, the EPA, the Bush administration, ExxonMobil even, everybody, when they said for real attribution, said, of course, humans are causing climate change and climate change is causing harm.
Mm-hmm. So speaking again with Dr. Victor Flatt, and I think another key question that people who don't want to change their behavior will keep coming up, like we're really good at coming up with ways not to change or to pass the buck. But one of the more, I guess, convincing arguments is, well, even if we do something, everyone else in the world is not doing anything or not doing enough. So do our ethical responsibilities change at all, or are they affected based on the actions of other countries, other people? Like, if China does nothing, do we still have the same responsibility as we would if China was in, like, absolutely at the forefront and making innovations and being number one on this?
Well, first of all, I guess it really depends on what code of ethics one aspires to. In most of our monotheistic religions, at least, the idea is that we have an ethical duty regardless of whether other people uphold that ethical duty or not. And so in that sense, it's like you tell your kids, just because another kid bullies somebody doesn't mean you should do it too. But then when you really look at sort of the facts of what's happening and how morality and ethics play off of each other, China is doing a lot now. They have actually taken, in many ways, they've taken a lead and a leading role in really reducing their energy consumption or changing their energy consumption to more climate-friendly policies. And part of the reason they can do that so quickly is, you know, perhaps they have a more authoritarian system than we do, but they are, in fact, doing that. And I think even if they were just starting to, or let's look at India, which is a little bit lagging in doing that, I believe that to the extent this is a worldwide problem, if you don't set a good example, you can't expect other people to do it either. And so even beyond the ethical responsibility we may have for the harm we have caused other people, if we just want to make sure other people do something, that's not going to happen unless we play our part.
Yeah. And going down from the national level to the individual level, what are our responsibilities as individuals? We should mention, because you and I were having this conversation before we started, but to let everyone else in, Dr. Flatt comes in with a coffee mug, gives it to me as I'm like pulling a bottle of water out for myself, and says, "You don't have to use the plastic bottle. Go to the drinking fountain and get it." So I've got my UNC Center for. Center for Climate, Energy, and Economics, and I'm drinking out of it now and will for the rest of the day. So
it's true. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hector you. But,
No, please do, because like every little bit, right?
Well, actually, you know what? That's a really good illustration of what things can happen and do happen on an individual level. So if you tell people about what they can do, right, to do, and essentially the answer here is to reduce energy consumption from fossil fuels. That's really the big thing. If you tell people what they can do, a lot of people will do it. And so giving them the option, saying, "Hey, you could use this mug instead of getting the plastic water bottle," like, "Oh, okay, yeah, I could use the mug. I can do that." And so part of it is, to the extent policy has a role in this, part of it is to sort of assist people to figure out what ways they can do and how they can be effective. And the other thing I think that's really important about this is that, you know, it's kind of like a micro version of your question about China and the United States. You know, some people think, well, what difference can one person make? But the point is, of course, what happens in the environment is a summation of all of the decisions that we all are making all the time. It's the same argument of how does one vote matter?
I was just thinking that.
Exactly.
Yeah, what individual difference do I make?
Right. And yet, if everybody thought that, nothing would happen. And we actually now have research from a really good professor at Vanderbilt Law School, Mike Vandenberg, who has really started to look at this, and Harry Osofsky, she's at the University of Minnesota. They both have noted that individuals do make a difference. Like, we tend to discount it because we think, oh, it's just, you know, a few people or it's a community or whatever. When you start adding it all up, that's actually what does make a difference. And if people don't come along with that, it's going to be harder to make that difference.
And there's the path dependency again, because you as an individual might not have any incentive to do things that are more environmentally friendly, but if literally everyone you know just takes it for granted that this is what you should do, then you're more likely to go along as well.
You are. And you know, the government can help out by making things easier, by making things cheaper. You know, we have decoupled energy growth from economic growth in this country and around the world for the first time apparently in human history in the last few years. And part of it is just, you know, efficiency savings. Like, we use light bulbs now that don't use as much energy. And just by doing that, that takes away 2 or 3% of demand for electricity. And that adds up.
Yeah. Again, speaking with Dr. Victor Flatt, UNC law professor, the Climate Change Ethics Symposium is going to be Friday, October 28th at the Graham Student Union on campus, 9:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. We'll have more information on this as we get closer to the day, but mark your calendars. This is open for everyone. It's all day. What do people need to know about the symposium?
Well, the symposium is I think, going to be really great and really interesting because it sort of looks at all these different aspects. It starts out by kind of just looking at how we live in this world, right? And how the world is changing. And that's really just important to learn about. And then it goes on to talk about something very specific, particularly for North Carolina, coastal impacts, right? And that's something a lot of people can really understand viscerally. Most people here have been to the coast. They understand what's happening. They can see it happening. And then we get to the bigger questions, which is the panel I'm on, about what does this mean about our responsibility to each other and the world?
All right. And again, 9:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. at the Graham Student Union, Friday, October 28th. That's the Parr Center Symposium on Climate Change Ethics. Dr. Flatt, before we let you go, one thing that individuals can do today to be more environmentally friendly.
This is going to sound strange, but I'm going to have to say two things. But the
okay.
first thing, the most important thing is to put people in elected office who share your views about environmental problems. I know that sounds kind of strange, but unless people actually vote based on what values they think are important, then things just, you know, policy does matter. So that's important. And then I think the second thing people could do is, this is good for you, it's good for your health. Take one day a week or one errand a week, just one, and take a walk or take a bike ride instead of driving. Just one thing. And you know, most people, it's a good time right now in this part of the world, usually, and it can be pleasant, and it's a way to, you know, think about, you can think about environmental issues as you take your
stroll.
Yeah,
yeah. One errand is a good start, because a lot of times you go and you do errands, and it might be three errands in kind of the same part of town,
right.
And it may only be a 5-minute or 10-minute walk to get from one to the other. You get in the car and drive, but if you just did that one walk.
Right, just one walk, you know, and it's probably good for you, too.
Yeah, that's the step in the right direction. All right. Again, Symposium on Climate Change Ethics, Friday, October 28th, 2 weeks from today. Mark your calendars. Graham Student Union on campus, 9:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. Session 3, the last one of the day, is the one that Victor Flatt is going to be on. So check that out especially. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.